Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Hey, everybody. Today we've got a special treat for you. This is a live episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, recorded on Friday, October 6th at the Hudson Mercantile in New York. This was an event associated with New York Comic Con, not a part of the con, one of those adjacent happenings. We had a nice friendly crowd come out. It was really good to see y'all. And so without any further ado, here's the episode.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey everybody, how you doing?
Good? Hey! Yeah. Nice cozy crowd.
Did everybody grab some shirts or some buttons or shirts and buttons?
Stuff okay. Is legit free.
Yeah. In fact, we don't want to bring any of it back home, so grab more of it until there's none of it on the way out.
You can re-gift it for Christmas or Halloween.
We prefer if you re-gifted
it for Halloween.
Really go hog wild with it.
Yeah. So this is a Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast. How many of you guys listen to this show? You know what to expect?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Who's a newbie here? Who's never heard us before?
All right. Okay.
Get ready.
Oh, wow.
The pressure is on to impress you then.
We're pretty weird. We might make you uncomfortable.
No.
Hope you're on board.
we'll get into this at the beginning. But yeah, so basically we're recording this. It's going to publish next week. So we're going to start the show like we normally do, and it's recording over there, and then we'll just proceed as normal, and then hopefully afterwards we'll have like a couple minutes to hang out.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, cool.
All right, well, let's kick it off. Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Christian Sager.
And I'm Joe McCormick. So if you are not familiar with us, if you're one of those newbies out there who raised your hand, we are the hosts of the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast, which is a science podcast out of the How Stuff Works office in Atlanta. The core of our show is science, but we take a pretty interdisciplinary approach. So we get into philosophy, religion, mythology, history, pop culture, of course. And that's where we're going tonight. So because we're here at the same time as New York Comic Con, how many of you are actually going to New York Comic Con?
Oh, cool.
Oh,
cool.
So a lot. Okay.
We were worried there was like confusion about whether or not you could come if you weren't a part of New York Comic Con.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you confused? I see a lot of confused faces.
I was confused.
All right. Is anybody here in costume? No?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah?
Cool.
Okay.
Nice.
Sort of? Okay. So we were doing this at the same time as New York Comic Con. So they were like, can you do something pop culture related? And we talked about it for a bit. And we decided, hey, how about the science of the show Stranger Things? Because do we have fans of Stranger Things out there? Yeah.
Let's do. Raise your hand if you have not seen Stranger Things. Okay.
Oh, okay. Right. We're going to try not to spoil the show.
We'll try to avoid
spoilers. But yeah. We're going to talk about how science relates to the show.
Right.
We might drop a couple things.
Because that's one of the really cool things about Stranger Things is that it's a fabulous show that's chock full of nostalgia, but they do a great job of bringing some science and some tantalizing pseudoscience into the show, sometimes just as kind of window dressing, but it adds to just the potency of the show, I believe.
Yeah, we actually have a quote from a physics expert later on. He spoke to this
and
basically said those guys did their homework. So that made it even more fun for us to cover this for an episode because there's a lot to dig into.
Right. So season two is coming up. We're big fans of the show. So we're going to talk about a few subjects related to plot points in the show. We're going to be talking about parallel universes, government psychic research, and the real life figure in the history of 20th century science who we think inspired, is it fair to say he's the favorite character of all three of us, Dr. Brenner.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Played by the one and only Matthew Modine.
Yes.
Hey, do you guys remember when Matthew Modine used to follow us on Twitter?
He did follow us on Twitter for like a week and a half.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't stop DMing us for
picks. That was like the highlight of our careers. So Matthew Modine followed us, and Robert and I did a high five. And then like maybe a month later, he unfollowed us. And then a month after that, Stranger Things came out. And we were like, what's going on here? We watched the show, and we were like, wait a minute. Matthew Modine is playing John C. Lilly in this. And John C. Lilly is one of our favorites. Like, if you ever listen to the show, we bring him up pretty much every episode. And we have a whole episode all about him.
Yeah, yeah, we do. And some of you might be wondering, well, who is John C. Lilly? What does he look like? Well, I'm going to explain some of this. But also, you all have tiny pocket computers in your possession. We will not be offended if you look up John C. Lilly or if you need a refresher on what Dr. Brenner looks like. I will refresh you, though. Dr. Brenner, of course, played by Matthew Modine, silver hair, as you recall.
Glorious
silver hair. Slim
figure.
Do you
think that's natural?
Pardon?
His hair, do you think it's natural?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Naturally silver?
Yeah,
he's a silver
fox. I think that's the actual color, yeah. But Brenner, as he's presented in the show, he's obsessed with, I think, connecting with other minds. So for part of that show, it's connecting with human minds, and then it becomes more about connecting with these extra-dimensional minds. And he initiates this contact with the other people, with extra-dimensional beings, through an isolation tank, a float tank, and then uses that float tank to enhance Eleven's psychic powers.
Okay, so give me the compare and contrast essay. How does that compare with the real John C. Lilly?
Okay, so for starters, John C. Lilly invented the isolation tank. Everybody out there, if you've ever gone and floated somewhere, you can thank John C. Lilly for bringing this into the world. In addition, he was a pioneer in the field of electronic brain stimulation. He mapped the pain and pleasure pathways of the brain, and he founded an entire branch of science exploring interspecies communication, mostly between humans and dolphins. He also got into a good bit of trouble with all of that, but we'll touch on that a little bit later on.
If you want the really dirty details, though, you should listen to the episode that we did just
that's right.
About
we did
John C. Lilly.
An episode a year ago.
I'll give you a quick hint, and then we'll just move on, because we're not going to talk about this here, but it involves sexual relations with dolphins, and it's pretty great.
Yeah, not really between Lilly himself, but it was
one of
his underlings.
The humans and dolphins.
Yeah. Lilly at the time was too busy taking massive quantities of LSD, floating himself.
He didn't have time for that stuff.
Yeah, and in using this experience to try and connect with the alien intelligence of dolphins. So, we have these two figures, right? And again, Brenner on the show is this very well put together, an old guy in the old fashioned suit. If you look up pictures of Lilly, you will find images of a man and like an older man in brightly colored, like loud shirts and sometimes a coonskin cap.
Right. He dresses up like he's like about to fight the Battle of the Alamo.
Yeah, he is dressed like you would expect a counterculture Timothy Leary-esque figure to dress. And so you might say, well, Brenner doesn't look anything like that. What possible connection could there be? Well, I was looking at a 2016 interview with Observer.com. And Matthew Modine himself mentioned that the Duffer brothers originally envisioned Brenner as, quote, an unshaven man in jeans and plaid shirts. And then Modine worked with the Duffers to sort of flesh this out and change it. Modine says that he drew on elements from anime, Alfred Hitchcock, Cary Grant, and Laurence Olivier.
And stuff to blow your mind.
Well.
He clearly followed us on Twitter solely so that we could help him figure out how to dress for this TV show.
Allegedly.
Matthew, are you here?
No, I don't think he showed.
Not yet. Well, hopefully by the end.
He'll come in later. Yeah, he'll come in later.
He might be late.
Okay, the crazy part, though, is that this version of a Lily-esque figure that we get on Stranger Things, he may not resemble that counterculture John C. Lilly, but he definitely resembles the establishment John C. Lilly that came before him.
So there's like a John C. Lilly arc.
Yes.
Where first he's this buttoned-up guy, and then later he becomes this cross between sort of like George Lucas in the 70s, and if you've ever seen the Mystery Science Theater episode, Final Sacrifice. You remember the old prospector? Pipper.
Yeah, he did kind of look like Pipper. But when he was younger, he was just kind of this square-looking but scary, I will say scary, government scientist. Let me just take a minute to roll through some of the basically the background of John C. Lilly. So John C. Lilly earned his physics degree from Caltech in 1938, his doctorate in medicine from the University of Pennsylvania in 1942, and as a faculty member, he studied biophysics and psychoanalysis at the University of Pennsylvania. And he was primarily interested in the physical structures of the brain and the seat of the conscious self. So even when he was, before he got all enlightened, he was still very interested in connecting with other minds. That was always his thing, whether it's physically or via the use of LSD later on.
But despite the unorthodox nature of his research, he did do a fair amount of working for the man, right?
Yes, a fair amount. Basically, he wanted to pursue his own agenda, and if the man was going to use him to, you know, to create ways to torment and extract information from Cold War spies, then he was on board.
Until he started cutting up the brains of macaques and dolphins.
Yeah, so he did this for about a decade, working for the National Institutes of Mental Health, or NIM.
Did he make those really smart rats?
Well, mostly he worked on macaques, and he did a lot of invasive cortical vivisection. So, again, not already he's off to some kind of nefarious work. I think a lot of us would agree. He had a pretty high security clearance. J. Edgar Hoover allegedly knew him by name. And his projects that he was involved with included reprogramming or brainwashing, sleep deprivation, and the operant control of animals via wires implanted in their brain. Whoa. Yeah, so some pretty scary stuff. And according to D. Graham Burnett's excellent Orion article, A Mind in Water, Lilly's unpublished paper, Special Considerations of Modified Human Agents as Reconnaissance and Intelligence Devices, included this quote. He wrote of, quote, a covert and relatively safe implantation of electrodes into the human brain for the, quote, push-button control of the totality of motivation and of consciousness.
So, but just to be clear here, he didn't put electrodes in the brain of 11-year-old girls with shaved heads?
No. There's no evidence that he actually, you know, did any of this to a human being, but he was up for it. If he had been given the okay.
Is he like, you feel like putting in an implant in somebody's brain this weekend?
Yeah, he would have been game, because you really get the impression that he was all in on anything scary the government wanted him to do, so long as it, you know, pursued his interest in connecting with other minds. Mm-hmm. This ended up leading him to conducting some experimentation with dolphins in Florida. And it was here where he began to have this empathic connection with dolphins. He began to, like, he performed a vivisection on a dolphin, and due to some of the quirks of dolphin physiology, you could not actually put the dolphin under for this. So it was like a live, conscious vivisection of the dolphin's brain. And this had a profound impact on Lilly. He ended up going down this path of promoting the welfare of dolphins, promoting the higher intelligence of dolphins. So he really helped bring about a cultural shift in how we perceive this animal, that it's not just another, you know, dumb animal in the water, but it's something that we should value, that we should protect even. And we wouldn't have Flipper if it were not for John C. Lilly.
So actually, this is a good point. I probably should have brought this up earlier, but there are two movies that you've probably seen that are very heavily based on John C. Lilly's life. The first of which is Altered States, and we'll talk more about that later when we get into the isolation tanks. But has anybody seen the film The Day of the Dolphin with George C. Scott? No one.
Really? Oh,
some
silence.
No? No. All right. So this is a, you go find it. This is a movie where George C. Scott essentially plays John C. Lilly and he teaches dolphins to talk
and to love.
Yeah. So like they call him Fa. He's their father and they say things like Fa loves Pa. It's great. Go watch it. If you want to see George C. Scott just hanging out with dolphins. But the other thing that we wouldn't have without him, he didn't influence this movie in terms of that it was about him, but The Creature from the Black Lagoon.
That's right. Yeah. The guy who played the creature, worked on Flipper and worked with John C. Lilly, while he was down in Florida. So, yeah, we can thank him for The Creature. And I would argue that if anyone ever gets around to actually remaking The Creature from the Black Lagoon, they should take inspiration from John C. Lilly's story and from Altered States and use that to bring us a proper creature film.
Yeah, you get a creature from the Black Lagoon with LSD and isolation tanks and dolphins.
Yeah.
Throwing some dolphins for
I'm
fun.
On board, yeah.
Yeah, that'd be great. Instead of like Tom Cruise running around.
I don't want to see Tom Cruise punch the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Just doing like exposition for 30 minutes.
Wait, so I have a question about y'all's predictions for Stranger Things. Do you think in upcoming seasons we're going to see Matthew Modine's character follow the same arc as John C. Lilly throughout his life? So will he coming back, he'll come back in future seasons, Hawaiian shirts, beard, long ponytail, gained a significant amount of weight, doing, you know, LSD orgies and stuff.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope by season four he is wearing the coonskin hat and helping the kids out.
So that's I didn't think about this until now, but
I'd watch
that. His ending was left open. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he's from a parallel universe, this other Matthew Modine.
Oh, my goodness. We could have multiple Dr. Brenners in one
All
in one
versions
film.
Of Brenner and Lily together at once.
I like it.
Floating in a tank taking LSD.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at CedarPoint.com.
So I want to shift now to explore a different element of Stranger Things, which is, of course, the government psychic research being conducted at Hawkins Laboratory, Hawkins National Lab, I think, in the show. That they say is being carried out by the Department of Energy. So I want to put you in a scenario. See if you can go into this place with your mind. Imagine you are a Defense Department analyst in about spring of 1970. And so you're just going to be washed head to toe in Cold War paranoia. You've heard these rumors about a secret electronic warfare device aimed at the American embassy in Moscow. And there are also these rumors about weird LSD mind control experiments going on over at CIA. You get the sense that we're in an age of unconventional warfare, where these strange new technologies are going to change the balance of power across the globe, and you don't want to fall behind.
This sounds like right now.
Yeah, except I guess a little less focused on like social media and, you know, it's Facebook for drones and
yeah, right.
More on like controlling people's minds and killing people with electronics, with electromagnetic beams.
Well, the thing is, in an age before social media, social media is kind of this weird sorcery that connects all of these minds together. And before you had that, the only thing you had was the possibility, however distant, of psychic communication.
Right. I mean, why would we need to do psychic research now when you can just get in somebody's newsfeed?
Yeah.
Anyway.
I mean, sadly, I mean, the research is
probably
showing that it's remarkably easy
to
alter someone's mind through, I mean, not in a science fictional way, but in a very scary real way.
That went to a scary place. Okay,
yeah.
No, let's go back to the Cold War where it's fine. So you're this analyst in 1970. One of your superiors calls you in for a meeting in a secured room. There is a projector screen, and somebody puts up, somebody gets a film going. And a title card announces that the following experiment took place at the Okhotomsky Military Institute in Leningrad on March 10th of this year. Then you see a 40-something woman, big bun of dark hair. She's seated at a table. And next to her is a man identified as Gennady Sergeyev, who is a Soviet military physician. And seated, on the table in front of the woman, somebody comes in and they set down a small jar containing a throbbing black lump. It's a frog's heart, and it's still beating. Now, the film explains that the extracted amphibian heart has been placed in what's known as Ringer's solution. It's a solution of salts that can keep muscles pumping even after they've been separated from circulation and from their electrical stimuli in the body. It's kind of like how, if you ever seen the trick where you salt frogs' legs, they'll start to twitch. And it's known that the Ringer solution can keep a frog's heart beating usually for about an hour. The heart is connected by wires to an electrocardiogram, an EKG, and so is the woman seated at the table. And then Dr. Sergeyev tells her to begin. So the woman puts her hands on the table, and she glares at the beating frog heart. And her heart rate increases, and her blood pressure increases. And the film also claims that, quote, heightened biological luminescence radiated from her eyes.
I imagine that she was doing the like psychic powers thing, like holding her temples really hard and squinting. But
you know,
her eyes glowed.
That's what they say. I mean, it's hard to tell in black and white, right? But anyway, After about 7 minutes of this, just staring at this throbbing black lump, the frog's heart abruptly ceases and stops beating. Then she does it with a second frog heart. So they bring in another frog heart.
They just have a bunch of frog hearts?
Yeah. Somebody's got an ice cream scoop back there, and they're just going to town.
So they have a bunch of frogs.
Right.
Not hearts.
Really excited for their big day.
Throw them on the table.
I think a melon baller would be more appropriate. Yeah. I think you can really get in there with them.
So she's don't know what frogs did to her, but she's killing the hearts. And I guess the frogs probably don't mind at this point. But next, she turns her attention to what's identified as a skeptical doctor in the room. And he doesn't believe any of this, but she concentrates on raising his heart rate telekinetically. And this goes on for about 5 minutes before Dr. Sergeyev, the attending physician, he steps in, says the experiment's becoming too dangerous, and he calls it to a halt.
This sounds like Scanners.
Michael Ironside. I'm going to scan everyone in this room.
Yeah. Right now.
It also sounds like such an obvious trick. It's such an obvious performance.
It seems a little over the top, right? We bring in somebody who doesn't believe. We'll show him. Anyway, this woman...
He's lucky his head didn't explode.
Yeah. This woman really existed. Her name was Ninel Kulagina, also sometimes mistakenly known as Nina Kulagina. Her life was truly remarkable in some ways. Kulagina was born in Leningrad in 1926. She enlisted in the Red Army along with the rest of her family when she was 14, and she served as a tank radio operator on the Eastern Front of World War II and was awarded the Soviet Military Merit Medal. Can you just imagine, it's like when you were 14, were you ready to get in a tank and fight Nazis? It's like, it's Nazis, you know, you're 14, get in the tank, let's go.
Yes. That was exactly how my childhood went. No, I can't. Did she drive the tank psychically?
I don't think so. I think she operated the radio. But she did believe that she'd been psychic since childhood, so who knows if it played into her military career.
But she only killed the hearts of German frogs.
I don't know the answer to that, Christian. So she's had this career, and in the 1960s, after the war's over, Kulagina, she makes a name for herself again when she shows up on Russian state TV, performing these demonstrations of psychokinesis, where they'd like have a big glass box that's all sealed off, and somebody put a salt shaker or something inside it, and she'd stare at it and then move it with her mind, or so they claimed. Now, everything I just described to you, Kulagina, the frog heart tape, that's all real. At some point, the Defense Department really did have analysts investigate this psychic kill tape. The question is, of course, what's going on in the film? If you're this hypothetical analyst in 1970, what do you do? Obviously, if you're like me, and I think like us generally, you assume, well, this is probably some kind of hoax. I mean, I'm not personally very keen on the existence of psychic powers. Either she's some kind of skilled illusionist hoaxing the Russians, or the Russians staged the whole thing as a hoax on us, trying to trick us into wasting money on parallel research. If that was the case, it worked. It worked. So, yeah, even if you are skeptical of what's going on, there are going to be people in the room with you who say, well, we can't be sure, and we sure as hell can't allow a psychic assassin gap. So, bring on the age of psychic research. Actually, the funny thing is, some amount of paranormal research had already been being funded by the government of the United States since at least going back to the 1950s. There had been interest in it at CIA and a few places here and there. But it was in the early 1970s that the psychic research really got underway.
Well, this is when we really got to the point where the government could throw just tons of cash down the well after it, right?
Right, yes. Rich country, worried about weapons gaps, worried about falling behind in this technology race I described at the beginning. Everybody's paranoid about the Russians getting an edge. So they're like, well, we might as well train some psychic spies and assassins and see if it works.
Do you think we have something like that going on now? But it's like a social media assassination gap.
There's a gap there too. But
the crazy thing about the psychic research is we know it continued until at least the 1990s and maybe even later. That's pretty cool, right? Like some people in here were alive then. Yeah. Anyway, so in Stranger Things, we've got this plot element of the character played by Millie Bobby Brown, of course, Eleven. She's the product of government psychic research. And if you want to know whether psychic powers are real, I can't answer that for you. If you're interested in my opinion, I'm extremely doubtful. But if you're interested in whether the U.S. government really did psychic research projects like the kind we see in Stranger Things, the answer is pretty much absolutely yes. They did stuff like that. Not so much with kidnapped children. They did it with consenting adults who claimed to be psychics. But all the types of experiments we see are mirrored by real-life research. So I want to talk briefly about a couple kinds of psychic research that were done by the government. Research on psychokinesis, which, of course, was being able to move things with your mind, and then research on remote viewing, which is seeing without the eyes. And I should also mention a couple of books that, if you want to go deeper on this subject, were also important sources for me when I was working on this. If you just want a slim and hilarious investigation into a grab bag of government paranormal research, John Ronson's 2004 book, The Men Who Stare at Goats, is excellent and full of really funny stuff.
This is the one upon which the movie is based, right?
Yes, exactly. Though there's a lot of stuff in the book, I think, that doesn't make it into the movie. For a more detailed history of U.S. government psychic research programs, you can check out a book just published this year called Phenomena by the journalist Annie Jacobson. This book is great for all the interviews and historical documents she pulls together, though I do want to warn you that she takes kind of a believer's line on it. Like, I think she is far too generous to the possible existence of psychic phenomena, and generally has the attitude that ESP is real and these experiments prove it.
That's surprising, given her pedigree.
Yeah, it sounds fun, though.
Well, it's a good history either way. So,
I mean, we all want to live in that world, but yeah. I mean, when it comes down to it, like, nobody has taken James Randi up on his $1 million prize.
Right. And so, he gets kind of rough treatment in this book. James Randi, if you're not familiar with him, is a stage magician, illusionist, who is a big antagonist of all these people who claim to be real psychics. And for years he did this thing where he had lots of money set aside for anybody who could come demonstrate the reality of psychic powers or ESP or telekinesis, anything like that, under controlled laboratory conditions. And a lot of times what people would say is like, oh, wait a minute. If there are skeptical scientists who don't believe in my powers present, they won't work.
So, I wish I could use that.
That is
more
the
often
worst
in my own life.
Superpower limitation.
Yeah, can you imagine saying that in a job interview?
Yeah. or what if 50% of all X-Men can only use their powers in a positive environment?
Right.
So work. Yeah, man, school would be rough, and they all live in a school.
So a lot of the government-funded psychic research of the kind like we see in Stranger Things, it took place at a think tank in Northern California called the Stanford Research Institute, or SRI, especially starting in 1972. And in 1972, SRI was the second largest research institute working for the Defense Department. Number one, of course, was the RAND Corporation. I found out not actually named after Ayn Rand. Kind of a disappointment.
It's named after Danny Rand from Iron Fist, because everybody liked that Netflix show so much.
Didn't you say he actually has
a corporation called Rand Corporation? Yeah. We were talking about this earlier. Does anybody know if the guy who created Iron Fist was just like a huge fan of Atlas Shrugged?
Nobody knows.
We couldn't figure it out. We thought maybe we'd ask around. But okay. Anyways, clearly
can't
this isn't the same
Rand Corporation.
Can't
believe you showed up without checking that out for us. Anyway, the SRI was doing all this research, and it had been founded right after World War II, so it had been around for a while before it got deep into the psychic research, but this was a serious government think tank that did real research. They got budgets reaching up to like $70 million a year. That's in like 1970s dollars. So some real money is going into this kind of stuff. And a major figure in this history, especially at SRI, is a guy named Harold Hal Puthoff. Now, Hal Puthoff was an SRI researcher who'd worked on laser physics, and he'd done these NSA supercomputer projects in the past. And in the early 1970s, Puthoff got really interested in research about psychic powers in plants. So there was this guy named Grover Cleveland Cleve Baxter.
Wait, repeat that?
Grover Cleveland Cleve Baxter. Like, call me Cleve.
What? Oh, I see. So did he rename himself, or did his parents just like
hate
him?
I think that was just his name.
Jeez. what I love about this name is that it sounds like one of the fake NFL player, or is it college football player names from the Key and Peele sketch, you know,
where
they all have ridiculous names.
Yeah, Cleve, Grover Cleveland, Cleve Baxter.
I'm going to just start adding Cleve Baxter after my name.
Well, it makes me think of Clive Barker, right?
Oh, so it's like Clive Barker, Clive Barker?
Yeah, so this guy was...
Baxter, Cleve?
Essentially, he wanted to make psychic plant Cenobites.
Huh. Oh, really?
Not quite. Okay, so let me get there. Baxter was a former CIA employee who used to administer polygraph tests for the agency. He probably not a cool guy. He was the kind of guy who'd like hook up new agents to a polygraph and ask them questions like, have you ever smoked the marijuana? Are you a homosexual? And stuff like that in the 1950s. And so one night, after hooking his lie detector machine up to a houseplant, he became convinced that plants could read our minds.
Do you think he was just bored and just sort of going around the house and hooking up various things like the nightstand and a punch bowl and then, let's try the fern, see what happens.
It's impossible to know for sure, but I think it's the opposite. I think he was more like manic and trying to find any kind of thing to do, and he just saw the lie detector machine, saw the houseplant, put two and two together and made and set a plant on fire to see if it would, you know... communicate with him psychically.
But wait, anyway, he did worse than set it on fire, right?
Wait, what?
What?
No.
Tell him what comes next.
Okay, so this other guy from SRI, Hal Putoff, so he got interested in this guy, Cleve Baxter's research, and Putoff proposed an experiment where he would grow an algae culture and then split it in half and then separate the two cultures by 5 miles and then torture one of the algae cultures with lasers to see if the other one would respond.
This is the thing that blows my mind.
Yeah.
That he had lasers to do it with. Like, he didn't just set it on fire or, I don't know, punch the algae? Like,
right. He was a laser researcher. He'd done lasers up and down.
Oh,
yeah?
So he just had lasers laying around, well, along with his lie-detecting machine.
The lasers make it more science-y, I guess. You
okay,
know?
Yeah. I see.
Because, right. Because
he can
otherwise...
beef up like his methodology section in the paper.
Yeah, it lends an air of credibility if you're doing defense research, right?
Well, you know, and if the lasers were not involved, it is a lot like, for instance, the powder of sympathy, which we covered on the podcast before.
The
supposed idea that that you could put a magic powder on a blade that it wounded a dog and it would make the dog yelp halfway around the world, and you could use this to navigate your sailing vessel.
This is a good thing to point out, because a lot of this research that was actually done in these labs throughout the 20th century sounds a lot like magical potions and occult beliefs from like the 18th and 19th century, except they've just sort of like put some sciencey sounding words in there, but the principles are the same.
Yeah.
Here's your sciencey sounding words. Putoff was interested in whether a hypothetical particle in physics called a tachyon could explain psychic communication between plants and humans. Tachyon is a hypothetical particle. Nobody's ever seen it before, but if it existed, what it would be is a particle that always moves faster than light. So no particle with mass in our universe can accelerate up to the speed of light. A tachyon would be something that could never decelerate down to the speed of light. And so he thought, yeah, maybe that's involved in psychic phenomena. Anyway.
Now, this is where John Carpenter got the idea, I assume, to have tachyons communicate with people's dreams in the past,
yeah,
right? In Prince of Darkness.
Prince of Darkness. Yeah. What a great movie. The best movie ever to feature a jar of Satan. Okay, so back to Putoff. Putoff got in touch with Baxter, and through being in touch with Baxter, he got to know this guy who is an artist and a writer and a self-proclaimed psychic named Ingo Swann. And this meeting—wait,
where are these names coming from?
These are real names, man.
This guy sounds like a villain in a Ghostbusters movie.
It does.
Ingo Swann?
Yeah, like he made the tower that'll bring forth the giant Slore.
Yeah, yeah. Or he has like a book all about like the book of Ingo Swann. Yeah.
Well, this guy apparently did. He would like dress himself in old like religious clothes he found at secondhand stores and stuff like that.
Okay.
But I don't know. I kind of admire that part of him. It's like, yeah, you just do you, man.
Well, and it sounds like
you
want to
wear a priest outfit. Go for it.
He sounds like he was a showman too.
Yeah.
And that's what we keep seeing time and time again with these examples. Is you have scientists and some showmen, and the scientists don't realize that what they have is a showman.
Right, exactly. So Putoff and Swann, Ingo Swann, they have this meeting, and this meeting kicks off this wave of paranormal research at the SRI that would continue throughout the 1970s. So Ingo Swann, he was this self-proclaimed psychic. He said he had ESP. He said he could do psychokinesis. And Putoff and colleagues claimed that Ingo Swann demonstrated all kinds of powers under test conditions that could not have been faked. For example, they claimed that he was able to demonstrate unexplainable psychokinesis, such as when he used his mind to perturb a magnetometer inside a quark detector buried under the basement of a research facility on Stanford University campus. And this led
That's incredible.
If he could actually do that, yeah. If the story is true, wow, that's an amazing thing to do.
Crushing a Coke can with your mind.
Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah. So in the show, we see these experiments where they're trying to get her to maybe kill a rabbit in a cage or crush a Coke can, which she successfully does with the Coke can. But yeah, this is something that you couldn't fake. It would be dealing with this thing deep underground. And the people at this experiment claimed that he did it. Now, as I've implied before, I'm doubtful about the truth of these claims, but that's what they said. They said, wow, he moved this thing and there's no way he could have faked it. So this led Putoff and a colleague named Russell Targ and a list of other sort of revolving collaborators to work for years with defense and intelligence grants to study psychic phenomena through the SRI. And then later there were all these derivative programs in the following decades. Like, for example, there was a remote viewing program run out of the Army out of Fort Meade, Maryland. Now, a lot of this research would end up focusing on the ESP phenomenon known as remote viewing that we mentioned earlier. That's seeing stuff you wouldn't be able to see with your own eyes.
And we see examples of this in Stranger Things.
Exactly.
Like, that's exactly what they're trying to get Eleven to do.
Yeah, like go to Russia and look at this guy and tell us what he's saying. Those were the kinds of experiments people wanted to do. In general, the most common form throughout the end of, or after the first year or so of this, was what came to be known as coordinate remote viewing experiments. So that would work like this. Psychic is given a set of map coordinates. Then the psychic would say what they saw there at the map, at the place on the map. You can see maybe a few ways that this could be a little bit flawed as an experimental design, right? Like if somebody went to go get a map and look and see what was there and then do some reading about it. But there are some cases where the researchers again insisted, like, no, there's no way they could have done that. It's absolutely real. But I want to give one example. So there was a remote viewer named Pat Price, who was kind of normal name here, right?
Yeah. Refreshingly normal.
He was famous for these amazingly detailed remote viewing results. Now, Price was born a Mormon, but he became a Scientologist in the 1960s, and he claimed that it was in the Church of Scientology that his powers were brought forth. I guess he was having a session with the E-meter and all that, and he gained the power to see things at long distances, so
he claimed. He was bitten by a radioactive E-meter.
How he got recruited is a pretty good story. Putoff and Swann met him in the parking lot of a farm where they were buying the office Christmas tree. Price sold them a Christmas tree, and then they recruited him for CIA remote viewing experiments. In one case, he supposedly was able to use remote viewing to give intricate, detailed descriptions of the inside of a restricted NSA base called Sugar Grove in West Virginia. Price was also known for the remote viewing of details of the Soviet facility in Kazakhstan known as URDF-3 for Unidentified Research and Development Facility 3. And Price, he drew illustrations of this gantry crane that were determined to be very similar to something that was actually photographed at the facility, and internal analysis concluded that he couldn't have done this, and I'm going to caveat this in a second, but they say he couldn't have done this unless either he actually saw it through remote viewing or he was informed of what to draw by someone knowledgeable of URDF-3. Now, I think maybe there could have been other possibilities, but even if you only accept those two possibilities, you got to wonder about the second one, and many people in these research circles did start to wonder, like, could his source of information be the disinformation arm of the KGB? Could some of these psychics giving us this information be feeding us disinformation, running psyops, basically, on our own programs?
But they didn't consider, like, maybe that he was doing, like, a cold reading?
Oh, I mean, that's a whole other question. Cold reading, of course, is the technique of, you know, looking for cues in the person you're talking to. It's a mentalism trick.
And also playing off their expectations of your knowledge, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's a way of using people's reactions to the things you're saying to give the impression that you're getting information that you couldn't possibly have, and really what you're doing is getting sort of hits and miss verification through their body language and their eyes and little things they mention that they don't realize they've given up. There are a lot of questions about what went on there. But I want to mention a couple other examples of government psychics who were doing this kind of stuff along the lines that we see Eleven doing in the show. You ever seen the performer Uri Geller? Who here is familiar with Uri Geller? Yeah?
I think, he's like a guy that would appear on Carson back
yes,
in the day,
yeah,
right?
He's the Israeli guy who bends spoons. So he claims to be a psychic, and his biggest act in his career was he would get a spoon and he'd use psychokinesis, so he claimed, to bend it. I don't know what spoons ever did to him, why he hates spoons so much. He's bent, you know, thousands of spoons in his career. And people seem to think this is really impressive. I think a lot of people who are only a little bit familiar with him don't realize that he claims his powers are 100% real. You know, he's like, yeah, I'm a real psychic. I'm not an illusionist. This is not an act.
Huh, okay.
Uri Geller was tested extensively by the SRI in the 1970s with these experiments like, what's in the box? Where they'd have a box and they'd roll a die in the box.
Gwyneth Paltrow's head.
Yeah, but here's the question. So Gwyneth Paltrow's head is in there. Which side of it is facing up? Is it her left ear? Is it the bloody stump of the neck?
Yeah.
And that's what he would have to guess.
Let me consult my psychic powers.
Yeah. Which side of the die is facing up? Another one would be like, can you look inside sealed aluminum film canisters and say what's there? Is it ball bearings? Is it magnets? And of course, again, we have these stories by the people conducting the experiments, like Puthoff and Targ, that he was able to get these results that are just impossible for him to have gotten by chance, impossible for him to have cheated. It's just too amazing. All the asterisks about skepticism there. And this is consistent throughout a lot of the literature. Many of the people who worked on these research projects have remained adamant over the years that they were able to prove psychic powers were real on the government's dime. And even some internal reviews on the value of these programs seemed kind of optimistic. Like, to quote from one report for the CIA put together in 1975 by the physicist J.A. Ball, who independently reviewed all the data, quote, a large body of reliable experimental evidence points to the inescapable conclusion that extrasensory perception does exist as a real phenomenon, albeit characterized by rarity and lack of reliability. Huh. Which is kind of, that last part kind of undercuts everything, doesn't it?
Yeah, because, I mean, if we were to take that on face value, and I mean, on one hand, yes, it's amazing if psychic phenomena were real, but then if it were not dependable at all, like, it'd be utterly useless for the government. You can't send in a psychic assassin and it's like, oh, well, there's like a 10% chance he'll be able to blow somebody's head up with his mind, and then 90% chance that he's just arrested and, you know, executed on the spot.
Or even worse, I mean, how about you're doing the remote viewing, right? You're the mm-hmm. person who's giving somebody the inside details of some Soviet research facility. And what you're trying to sell is, well, my results are amazingly accurate about 1 out of 100 times.
Yeah. And then it's not necessarily a situation where they would be, it's like, oh, well, I don't see anything, sorry. It's they would be giving you false information, perhaps just made up information. It would be just completely unreliable for any government purposes.
Yeah, so another problem with all this research, I think, is that based on my reading, it seems that while we keep getting all these people involved in this research who say, yeah, the phenomena is real, psychics are real, we've shown it over and over again in these tests, this research and all of its administrative levels just seems crammed with people who, in this parapsychologist Gertrude Schmeidler's terminology, are sheep, meaning people who are committed in advance to the belief that psychic phenomena are real, as opposed to her term goats, for people who believe in advance that it is not real. As I've said before, I think I'm kind of a goat, but if you have a whole lot of people who believe very strongly in a thing working on experiments to prove that thing, you're probably not going to get a lot of objectivity in your methodology.
Yeah.
And so this is a criticism that's been leveled against this research for a long time. I want to give a couple examples real quick of the kind of sheep thing going on. So a major figure in the remote viewing research conducted out of Fort Meade, Maryland, was like they would give people these coordinates or these places to view, and it might be a place of strategic importance, right? So here's a Soviet base. Or there's even one story that these psychic spies out of Fort Meade were supposed to see what was happening inside Tehran during the Iranian hostage crisis.
Now, yeah. you can easily imagine, though, the situation there is, we're trying to figure out how to handle the situation, and then someone says, well, do you want our psychics to take a crack at it? And
yeah, why not?
And well, Jimmy we have Carter's psychics. Like, sure.
We're paying for them. We might as well see what they got. Maybe they got nothing, but try it out.
I don't know if I believe it's true. I think I heard that Jimmy Carter was aware that this had taken place.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Anyway, so at Fort Meade, one of the major figures involved in the remote viewing projects there was this guy named Ed Dames. Have you ever heard of him before? He shows up sometimes on, what's that show, Art Bell, Coast to Coast, where they talk about UFOs and stuff. So he was a guy who worked on this project for the Defense Department, and he was intensely interested not just in the strategic targets, but in having his remote viewing agent spy on stuff like the alien bases of the Galactic Federation scattered throughout the solar system, which are the forward advance posts of these aliens that are going to colonize our solar system.
Okay, sounds reasonable.
Yeah.
This is what happens when you build a team of government psychics, right?
I mean, right.
You end up spying on the Galactic Empire.
Yeah, and so there were some people, you know, in various ranks who were a little bit doubtful about whether that was a useful research project. In John Ronson's The Men Who Stare at Goats, Ronson claims that one of Dame's personal remote viewing projects was using ESP to determine the true nature of the Loch Ness Monster, which he eventually determined was the ghost of a dinosaur.
Yeah. That
sounds pretty good. That.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's better than any of the other ones I've heard.
Which is sadder, that it's the ghost of a dinosaur or that it's the last living dinosaur and it's all alone?
I think the last living dinosaur would be far sadder. Would be just so, like, hideously
inbred. If it's a ghost, it can, like, hang out with its other dead ancestors.
Yeah.
At least a ghost, you can imagine, has delight in haunting people.
Has there ever been a ghost dinosaur movie?
Ooh, there's a ghost shark movie.
Okay.
So,
all right.
Maybe.
We need to get on that, copyright that.
Okay, one final anecdote, also from Ronson's The Men Who Stare at Goats. And this is, I think, exemplary of the kind of thing that may have been going on to give people who were working on these psychic experiments the impression that they were turning up real phenomenon. Ronson interviews this guy who worked at the Fort Meade project named Lynn Buchanan. And he also interviews another remote viewer named Joseph McMonagall. And Buchanan tells Ronson the story about McMonagall's amazing psychic powers. One time, there was a locked door at the facility at Fort Meade, and McMonagall used his psychic powers to remote view what the key to the door looked like, and then he made a sketch of the key from that psychic vision, and then took it to a locksmith, and had the locksmith make a copy of the key from the drawing, and the key worked, and he was able to open the door. If true, that would be amazing, right? But in his interview with Ronson, McMonagall admits that what had actually happened there was that he had picked the lock, and he didn't want to deflate morale among the other psychic spies, so he didn't tell them that. He just let them believe that it had been this psychic adventure.
I mean, that's
because they have to be in a positive environment.
But it's a classic magician's trick here, right? I mean, it's you can't see what I'm doing with this hand because all the stuff this one's doing. This one's busy running to the locksmith.
This one's picking a lock.
Yeah. So in final explanation, I mean, there are a lot of things that could have been going on in these experiments that people claimed were giving these amazingly accurate results and proving the truth of psychic powers. In some cases, you have to assume there may have been fraud or trickery. It may have been disinformation at some level. It may have been internal psyops campaigns. There may have been hoaxers. I mean, plenty of skeptics allege that the psychics like Uri Geller were just doing sleight of hand tricks and tricking the scientists. Mm-hmm. But also, I think among the researchers themselves, there is probably a strong tendency towards what's known as cherry-picking, meaning that maybe sometimes the remote viewers did have some truly amazingly accurate descriptions of stuff they wouldn't be able to see, but what if these amazingly accurate hits were like 4 or 5 sessions out of thousands?
So you think that's what Matthew Modine's up to in Stranger Things? He's just like he
oh, right.
every for a thousand days he makes 11 try to crush a coke
Yeah, well,
can.
They just cut a lot of the scenes out.
Yeah.
Well, that's
the director's cut.
That's one way remote viewing is different than psychokinesis. So if you make somebody try to crush a coke can with their mind without touching it 1,000 times and they can only do it once, I'm still impressed. Like if you can rule out some kind of intervention.
Like that's the kind of thing that would have won the James Randi prize.
Exactly.
If you could without touching it, just crush that can with your brain.
Right, with proper controls in place, mm-hmm. and you can do that, there, boom, you've got the prize, psychic phenomena are real, I'm still impressed, even though you could only do it once. With remote viewing, you know, you could say, I've got a picture here that you can't see, describe it for me. If you do this hundreds of times, and a few times you come up with a pretty accurate description, I'm not impressed, that's just, I mean, you could do that randomly. You're just monkeys on a typewriter.
Hmm. Yeah, they're bound to pound it out eventually.
Anyway, so one difference between this type of government psychic research and the stuff we see in Stranger Things is that I never came across any examples. There may have been some out there because there's still some classified stuff, but I never came across any examples of psychics using an isolation tank to enhance their powers, which is one of my favorite set pieces on the show.
That might be why they didn't have a positive environment all the time. You need an isolation tank to feel good about yourself.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because, let's just start with isolation tanks. Who here has floated? Who, raise your hand if you have floated, if you've been in an isolation tank.
This guy should host the show. He's like on top of it.
All right, so keep your hands up. Now keep your hand in the air if you've been in one more than once. All right? Okay.
Did you hallucinate? Okay.
Yeah, no hallucinations.
So Robert has floated in
but
an
only
isolation
once.
Tank, and I have floated, but only once. Joe?
I would love to try it. I tried it once at home in the washing machine, and it just didn't.
Joe,
no good.
Well, we all float down here, Joe.
I'll float with you someday.
Well, I think that the show does a pretty great job of
yeah.
explaining how it works. I mean, it's salt. It's buoyancy. You're floating in the water. If you've done it before, you know that the first time you float, a lot of it is about just getting used to the fact that you're in this body temperature, high salt mixture,
mm-hmm.
And it's like stinging every sensitive part of your body, like cuts and scrapes you didn't realize you had or yeah. crying out to you.
Oh, God. I mean, that seems like with all the other deprivation, that would have the possibility of reducing your entire consciousness to a hangnail.
Yeah, because it does play with your consciousness. I mean, that's why people climb into them, and that's why John C. Lilly that's why he invented it. That's why they were researching this at NIM.
Now, we should clarify, though. The isolation tanks that you see in Altered States or in Stranger Things are usually different than what you would just go to at like a commercial place. So the ones that we floated in at mm-hmm. least were horizontal and you're kind of laying on your back. So you can smell.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
sort of see.
Yeah. You definitely smell. Cause that was like, that distracted me from most of my first float was, my only float was that, wow, it really smells salty in here.
Dude,
and I don't know why I was surprised.
We gotta go do a double float.
The thing. They always say you need to float more than once because that first float is just about getting used to all
we'll
the
We'll bring
the
Joe
weirdness.
And make we'll record it.
Yeah, we should. But the tanks that Lily was using at NIM, they were they had a nightmare quality to them,
yeah.
I guess you'd say. The individuals were dressed in something that kind of looked like a GIMP costume with these like big blackout goggles.
It was
a
like
luchador mask,
right?
Yeah, kind of like a really scary luchador mask. and they found that it had a pretty severe effect on the subjects because you're essentially locking someone away with the inward facing mind, and it doesn't take much of that to start playing with your sensations and playing with your thought process. I mean, it's the reason that solitary confinement
right.
is such a hellacious thing to inflict on somebody.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's widely considered a form of torture now.
Yeah.
And this is basically what they wanted, though.
Yeah, because they were researching, quote, psychological stability of human beings under sustained isolation and reduced sensory input.
Little did they know, like, 40 years later, people would pay money to do this.
Well, I mean, this is an area that parallels that duality with Lily of establishment Lily, counterculture Lily. Establishment Lily was all about, let's get this thing, and we're going to take potential spies, we'll lock them away in there, and when they lose their mind, they'll tell us everything. And then counterculture Lily was like, no,
this is
you
awesome.
Need to lose your mind in here on LSD.
Maybe. I can talk to dolphins.
And then potentially talk to alien dolphins.
Yeah.
Man, that Lily mentality of like the self-experimentation is something I have this big conflict about, because on one hand, it's like, I like admire it. You know, I'm like, somebody wants to experiment on themselves. I'm like, that's confidence. That's courage. At the same time, that's usually not good science, right? Because it's hard to be objective when you're experimenting on yourself.
It tends to suggest an impatience that is generally not compatible with scientific rigor.
Right, or trying to get around ethical boundaries that would exist if you were experimenting on others.
Yeah.
Okay, so we can say Matthew Modine, as far as we know so far, and I refuse to refer to him by whatever his character's name is. Matthew Modine.
Dr. Brenner.
Whatever. Matthew Modine is a patient doctor because he hasn't experimented on himself yet in the show.
It's true. They're probably saving that for
season. But that's coming up.
So Lily really got into it. He, when he floated himself in this nightmarish contraption, he saw a limitless possibility here, and a way to just like to get in touch with the unaffected mind, like the mind without any of the weights of sensation, and he ended up writing about it pretty much for the rest of his life. His writings are really interesting if you ever give them a try, because it kind of waffles back and forth between being like academic writing and being like stream of consciousness writing, but in an appealing way.
He wrote while he was high in an isolation tank.
Maybe. It's really hard to write in that. But I have a quick quote from him, though. This is from Lily, Tanks for the Memories, Flotation Tank Talks from 1995.
Wait. Tanks for the Memories.
Yeah.
This guy's great.
He wore that coonskin cap, remember?
Yeah.
And his one of his favorite names for the tank itself was the Womb to Tomb Wet Box.
Wow.
We should all start incorporating that into our daily conversations.
Dad jokes from the 13th plane.
Yeah. But here's the quote. He said, "At the highest level of Satori from which people return, the point of consciousness becomes a surface or a solid which extends throughout the whole known universe. This used to be called fusion with the universal mind or God. In more modern terms, you have done a mathematical transformation in which your center of consciousness has ceased to be a traveling point and has become a surface or solid of consciousness. It was in this state that I experienced myself as melded and intertwined with hundreds of billions of other beings in a thin sheet of consciousness that was distributed around the galaxy, a membrane."
So what's fascinating about this to me, where you give like a quick like a foreshadowing, is because my section's all about parallel universes, and he's essentially using the language of parallel universes, of the multiverse, to describe this.
Yeah, so that quote kind of sums up just how high-minded and essentially mystical and magical Lily got with the isolation tank. We're not going to really go into the dolphin research, but that becomes a whole area where he definitely kind of becomes a scientific pariah, certainly within dolphin research, for the rest of his career.
So I'm curious, what does rigorous research say about the real-life effects of using these isolation tanks?
Well, we do have a fair amount of research to go on here, and a lot of just personal anecdotes from people who have floated a lot. Floaters often report hallucinations, out-of-body sensations, increased introspection, because ultimately you're locked in there, and you're not locked in there, but I mean you feel
you're
slightly...
You're not doing it right if you're not locked in there.
you feel as if the limits of your body are kind of harder to define because of the body temperature water you're floating in. Floaters, like sleepers, tend to experience decreased alpha waves and increased theta waves in the brain. So this is the stuff of dreams.
Except you're still awake.
Yes. You shouldn't fall asleep in there. Also, sensory deprivation, even of a single sort, so just sight or sound, etc., can produce hallucination. A voice or rumble heard in total silence. The light seen in total darkness. That sort of thing.
Yeah, we've talked about this before with like the creepiness people report when they go in an anechoic chamber. This is like a room with acoustic properties so that sound is really muffled. You know, nothing echoes. Everything's very, very quiet. People feel like they're going crazy in there. They start to imagine they're hearing their own brain work and stuff. It troubles you.
Yeah, and in fact, a 2009 study published in the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease found that a mere 15 minutes of near total sensory deprivation was enough to trigger vivid hallucinations in many test subjects.
Now, were those people who already had some kind of condition that would make them prone to hallucinations, but they were just normal people?
I think these were just normal, run-of-the-mill, averagely brought into the study people. Yeah.
Wow.
But they were all psychic.
No.
Not before the experiment.
Oh, only
yeah.
After.
Another 2009 paper, this one from Psychopharmacology, explored the possibility that sensory deprivation induces psychotic symptoms non-pharmacologically. And the idea here is that sensory depth disturbs error-dependent updating of one's worldview and leads to problems with top-down perceptive constraints resulting in hallucination. However, I do want to point out that this particular study, they used a sensory deprivation tank with a panic button. So they told people, all right, you're going to get into this, and you might start feeling, it might just get too much for you. You're going to feel kind of freaky, but you can panic and hit that panic button. Whereas other studies have just had the scientists say, hey, when you've had enough, just tap on the lid, and we'll let you out.
So this is like if you went to yoga, and they said, here's a panic button, just in case. Like, you're probably not going to have that great a class.
Yeah, it's like if you were going to yoga and your mom was talking to you beforehand and said, now, hold on, I've heard that some people really hurt their neck doing that, or I know a friend who hurt their wrist doing yoga. Yeah, you're going to go and you're going to be terrified that you're going to paralyze yourself on the mat.
Yeah, like you're trying to figure out if your kid's going to have nightmares for some reason. They're going to bed, and you say, now, don't think about machete mimes. Just don't think about machete mimes, and it'll be fine.
I mean, this is why priming is so important to ancient traditions involving the use of psychedelic substances. Mm-hmm. It's important for modern practitioners who take a serious approach to the use of psychedelic substances, and even yoga. It's about priming the individual for what's going to occur. And speaking of which, there's a 1987 study that I came across on prayer and mystic experience, and they found that when placed in an isolation tank, people with differing religious orientations related differing specific religious imagery, which is no surprise, but not in non-religious imagery and other phenomenal experiences.
So there's like more similarity among stuff not related to your particular beliefs.
Yeah. And I think this is interesting, too, in light of the sort of negative, positive experiences in priming that we're talking about here. And even the aims of John C. Lilly, or a fictional Dr. Brenner, even. I also think it's fascinating to think of isolation chambers used as laboratory stand-ins for prayer. Because what is prayer but an attempt to communicate with an extra-dimensional entity? And that's exactly what Dr. Brenner is trying to do with Eleven on the show Stranger Things.
Oh,
well, yeah, it makes you think about how a lot of religious rituals are actually, all throughout history are used to bring about some form of an altered state of consciousness.
Yeah.
I mean, you could think about even an act as simple as the repetitive activity of prayers, like the repetitive words you say in a prayer. If you've never tried this, just say the same sentence or the same word 500 times in a row. You will probably achieve some kind of mildly altered state of consciousness, mainly because it starts to disrupt the part of your brain that automatically processes linguistic content. If you've ever like tried to not hear what a word means when somebody's saying words, you can't do this on purpose. You can't help but hear what the words mean. But if you say the same word to yourself hundreds of times, you start to lose the connection between the sounds of the mouth and the meanings.
And the beautiful thing about this is you do not need LSD or a swimming pool full of salt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just repetition.
Yeah.
It's the way of the world.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, well, here's a question for you, Christian.
Okay.
Say you get into your flotation tank or your children's swimming pool full of salt water.
Okay.
And you reach out to an extra-dimensional entity.
Oh.
Where okay. is that entity? Like, scientifically, where is the you are here arrow for that being?
Right. So, well, what we have to clarify here is the difference between... You're talking about alternate dimensions or extra dimensions versus parallel universes.
Ah.
And Stranger Things seems to be unclear on what's going on there, right?
Well, basically, I guess what's going on with Stranger Things, obviously, is that this is a fairy realm. This is a typical trope of, yeah. Of various, dimensional travel, science fiction or fantasy. The upside down is like the realm of shadow as they draw that comparison in the
what
show.
What is it in Zelda? It's like the dark world or something.
I don't know,
never.
Man.
Yeah, I mean, it's a version of this world, but with slight, it's dark and it's toxic and it's slightly altered.
Well, okay, so there's science fiction fans, probably all in this room, that are familiar with the idea of parallel universes or alternate dimensions. They've been in our fiction, our pop culture, yeah. and comic books and TV and movies for decades now, right?
What's your favorite fictional parallel universe?
Oh, mine's Crisis on Infinite Earths from DC Comics. I like, because there's an infinite amount of them.
I have to go with the realm of the Goblin King in Labyrinth.
Oh, that's so good. I have to go with the Super Mario Brothers movie where they go to the other parallel dimension where Dennis Hopper is King Koopa.
So, but with all of those, it actually turns out that there is some basis in scientific theory for a multiverse. And I'm going to present you with three possibilities here, and we can try to crack the nut of what's going on here in Stranger Things. So right after Stranger Things came out, Popular Science interviewed this theoretical physicist named Brian Greene.
Oh, yeah, he's from New York City.
Yeah, and they asked him about Stranger Things, and the first distinction he made is what I was just talking about. He's like, whoa, there's a difference between alternate dimensions and parallel universes. Don't just use those interchangeably. We kind of do in pop fiction, but he wanted to clarify the difference. So here's the difference. An alternate dimension implies you've got one universe, right? And that universe has more dimensions to it than what we can perceive. So beyond the three dimensions of space and the one dimension of time.
So, yeah, it's like if you imagine that we are squares or triangles and suddenly we encounter a cube or a sphere or something, we just like wouldn't be able to perceive this extra dimension of it.
Exactly. Yeah, you wouldn't even be able to see it or hear it, any of your senses, right? Whereas a parallel universe implies the whole multiversal proposal. This is that there are multiple universes, but each one of these universes has three dimensions of space and one dimension of time to them. So why should we trust this green guy? Well, he's kind of a big deal in science. But remember the scene in Stranger Things when the teacher is using the analogy where he's talking about the tightrope walker on the tightrope and how there's a flea underneath it? That analogy originally comes from Green's book, which is called The Fabric of the Cosmos. So this guy, they basically researched him to figure out how to write the stuff about the Upside Down on the TV show. And in fact, Green himself says, whoever is writing this show is well-versed in some of the popular descriptions of these ideas. Whether it's mine or not, it doesn't really matter.
Oh, yeah. That doesn't really matter.
And then he added, also, if there's a monster, its head should open like a flower.
Yes. Yeah.
It's like, just my two cents as a scientist.
That's also his other book.
Yeah. If you've never seen a picture of the physicist Brian Greene, he's a favorite of ours on the show. He comes up a lot. You should look him up because I think he looks a lot like David Duchovny.
He does, doesn't he? Yeah. He kind of does.
So, total tangent. Sorry, please continue.
So let's stick with the three major theories, though, and Green outlines these, but some other people do as well. So the very first academic proposal of parallel universes came in 1954 by this guy named Hugh Everett III.
Old Hugh.
And Hugh came up with what we now call many worlds theory. And he did this while he was a doctoral student. So he hadn't even graduated yet. And he's like, hey, this is my dissertation. There's parallel universes. And just like drops a big book on the table. And he says, look, they're related to ours, they're all branching off, others branch off of them, yada yada. So to better understand this, though, I'm sorry, everybody, we're going to have to talk about some quantum physics for a little bit. It's a little painful, but I'm going to try to boil it down and make it as easy for all of us as possible, because it does hurt my head a little bit.
Oh, come on. Positive thinking. It's not painful. It's no, quantum physics.
Well, everybody think positively and my psychic powers related to quantum physics
will
work.
I do, but there is a famous quote about quantum physics where if it does not make your head hurt a little bit, you're not engaging with it properly, right?
Is it Richard Feynman, the famous physicist, who said that if you think you understand quantum physics, you don't understand quantum physics?
That's what I'm paraphrasing.
I'm afraid I'm misquoting. I don't think so.
Okay. So Everett was inspired by two scientists that were quantum physicists. And they were Werner Heisenberg and Niels Bohr. And Heisenberg suggested that if you just observe quantum matter, that we're affecting its behavior, just looking at it. And he said, subsequently, we can never be sure of what its attributes are. This is called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So here's an example. Here's an example I cribbed from our colleague Josh Clark from Stuff You Should Know. He has this great analogy, and he says, imagine you're looking at Joe, specifically Joe, and Joe is a human being who's solid, okay? Now, everybody look away from Joe, and then when you look back, all of a sudden, Joe is made out of gas.
I hope it's radon gas.
So that is essentially the idea behind the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, that like the attributes of the physical form change every time you stop looking at it and look at it again, right? And it's suggesting essentially that, and this is where Bohr comes in, he's this Danish physicist, and he says, well, actually, it doesn't exist in one state or the other. It exists in all states simultaneously. But like Heisenberg, he says it's got to stay in one form as long as we're looking at it.
So this is, you probably heard of this as the Copenhagen interpretation. This is the idea that, you know, a quantum event is both A and B at the same time until it interacts with something that forces it to collapse into one or the other.
So Everett comes along, he's working on his dissertation, and he argues, okay, I agree with Bohr on everything except for one respect. He says, measuring and observing quantum objects don't actually force it into a comprehensible state. What it does is it splits it into an entire other universe. And he says this literally duplicates the universe every time you observe quantum matter, and then that subsequently splits every other time any action is taken or not taken related to it. So this is like the infamous stuff that you see in you know, pop science, popular fiction, where there's an alternate universe where I'm a bank robber and not a podcast host, right?
Yeah.
Because I just didn't decide to rob that bank that one time.
And under many worlds, there probably would be such a universe because there's an infinite number of quantum events to split the universe an infinite number of times.
Well, it's like the Library of Babel. It's the idea that it's a library that contains not only all books, but all possible books.
Right.
So this is usually called daughter universe theory, okay? Now, let's put it in Stranger Things terms. So let's say 11 is our quantum object. When you look at her once, she appears to be a little girl. You turn away, you look again, maybe she looks like the Demogorgon. That's Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Then Niels Bohr was suggesting that a quantum 11 is both the little girl and the Demogorgon at the same time and all other possible forms. Like there's one where she's played by Carrie Fisher and she's that form simultaneously with, you know, infinite other ones. And then Everett comes along and he says, but wait, every time 11 is measured or looked at, say by Matthew Modine, then it causes a split in the universe and this creates a daughter universe. And so subsequently, there's just all these parallel universes that are based on the observation of the quantum 11.
Now, as crazy as this sounds, a lot of physicists actually do hold to the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. It's something that's popular. I know recently on the show we talked about the Caltech physicist Sean Carroll. I know he favors the many worlds interpretation. So it is taken seriously by real physicists.
But,
and it's a good way of thinking that there's a lot of other universes out there, but could you get between them?
Yeah. How do we get from here to Demogorgon?
Yeah, many worlds doesn't really get into that as far as I could tell, but that's one possible explanation, I guess, for what the upside down is, right? Another possibility is string theory. We've all probably heard this thrown around. It's related to Albert Einstein's theory of everything. It proposes that there's an even smaller level than quantum, the quantum level. There's the sub-quantum level. This is like in Ant-Man where he shrinks down like so small that it just turns into this psychedelic nightmare.
So small that the CGI budget for the entire film just implodes upon itself.
Yeah.
Approaches infinity.
So the argument here is that all the essential building blocks of all matter and all physical forces exist on the subquantum level, and here there are these things that are referred to as rubber bands, basically, that are strings, and they make up quantum particles, and then that makes up everything else. Like everything in this room, every force of nature is all made up of these strings.
Well, it is a theory of everything.
Exactly. That is exactly what it is. It is entirely theoretical. So there's no, I should be clear about this, there is no evidence that this is true. Some scientists feel like this discredits it entirely, but it's worth bringing that up because string theory also ends up leading us into a theory of parallel universes. So this theory says, okay, parallel universes exist like bubbles next to each other. And when they come in contact with one another, it's because gravity flows in and out of these bubbles, back and forth to each other. But every time these universes interact, a big bang occurs, just like the one that created our universe. So every time they touch, it creates another universe. But what we don't know is what happens when these, you know, to these actual bubbles themselves. Like, do they explode? Is it really bad? Or is it totally benign?
Well, it's worth keeping in mind, like, when it creates another universe, it's not like a total fantasy universe where it's like, oh, here's a universe where everyone is a Nazi. Here's a universe where everyone has a sheep's head or something.
Yeah, that sounds like a great universe.
This is more like, here is a new Big Bang and a new contained universe, and who knows what it it results in. It's very much like the Library of Babel, where many of the books, I mean, I guess the majority of the books in the Library of Babel are illegible, right?
Almost every single one, yeah.
It's only
the vanishing minority that makes sense.
Yeah.
So Brian Greene, remember him? He actually argues that the recent discovery of gravitational waves make this slightly testable. So it might actually have some evidence in the next couple of years. You might have noticed this week, the scientists who discovered gravitational waves won the Nobel Prize. So that's probably why it's a big deal. I mean, there's lots of reasons why it's a big deal, but that's one of them. Maybe we'll find parallel universes. So they're hoping that they can test string theory with that. And then the idea here is essentially that as the universe expands, each one of these strings is getting stretched out. And as they're stretching, it produces a crack. And it's not an audible crack. It's a crack that exists through gravitational waves. So the researchers are hoping that now that they've discovered gravitational waves, they can test them and subsequently maybe find strings and or sub-quantum reality.
That's fascinating. I mean, we've talked about string theory on the show before and never come across a good way to test it today. It's always sort of one of those things where they say, maybe on the next high-energy particle collider, we'll get to high enough energies that we can test it.
Yeah.
But so, I hadn't heard of this.
So in terms of Stranger Things, okay, if we're using string theory here, maybe the Upside Down is one of these bubbles, and then the Stranger Things, like, real world is another bubble, and they touched. And then that means that while they could pass back and forth between one another, they would have created another Big Bang. So we might see a third universe.
Okay.
That's a possibility.
And the Upside Down is just a universe that happened to turn out just like ours, except a little icky looking.
Sure.
Okay.
Now the final theory is called eternal inflation. I love that name. And it argues that if you could zoom back and look at all of space-time simultaneously, you'd find that some areas of space stop inflating the way that the Big Bang did, and that others continue at like a rapid pace. So some parts are inflating, some aren't. They're all at different rates. And guess what? They use the bubble metaphor too. They couldn't come up with their own thing. So they've got this bubble metaphor. Our universe is a bubble. It's in a network of other bubbles. But the big difference here is that the universes in these potentially have different laws of physics than ours do. So this is a combination idea of parallel universes with alternate dimensions, which makes it a little more complicated. But it's essentially asking, like, what's going to happen if these bubbles collide, right? Now, astrophysicist Ethan Siegel came along in 2015, and he added a limitation or maybe a complexity to this theory that I think makes it more fun. He says, well, here's the thing. Space-time could go on forever in theory, but our universe, we know our universe is measurable and that it's under 14 billion years old, so it's not infinite. Therefore, it subsequently has to have a limit to the number of ways that particles can arrange themselves in the universe. So, again, this is all these different possibilities that lead to physics, but not an infinite amount of them. Okay. There's another theory, though, that's kind of buried inside of eternal inflation theory, and it's called Brains Universe Theory. And Brains is spelled B-R-A-N-E-S.
This is what you're referring to when I read the Lilly quote, where he's talking about membranes.
Membranes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, so he's using language that's, you know, steeped in this stuff. It imagines this, though, that these universes are all intersecting and overlapping, but instead of using the bubble metaphor, they say, in Brains Theory, they say, well, it's like bread. It's like a bunch of slices of bread, and they're all stacked on top of each other. And they call these brains, and each one of these brains has three dimensions. But if you refine the idea, and maybe there's some more complex versions of these brains, some have three dimensions, maybe some of them have 17 dimensions, and when they overlap, what we would experience is in three dimensions, because our bodies are physically only able to perceive that many dimensions, plus time. So maybe what's going on in Stranger Things is actually these two universes have overlapped, and what they're experiencing in the Upside Down is sort of like the middle of like a Venn diagram, right?
I like this theory because this would explain why there is a swimming pool, why they see like just a shadow version of their own world.
Yeah, it's just like slightly different because they're not able to perceive all of these other dimensions of reality that are occurring around them. So here's where it gets exciting, because this theory has a lot of evidence that seems to make it look like it's possible. In 2005, a paper was published in Physical Review Letters that said, oh, we just found this big cold spot in space, and we detected it with NASA's WMAP satellite. Then in 2008, two more studies were conducted to try to detect this as well. And they did this by looking at cosmic microwaves. And the reason why is because cosmic microwaves are left over from the Big Bang and have cooled down to about 2.7 kelvins. This is like a thing that we know. We can kind of measure it. Sometimes throughout the universe, it's a little hotter. Sometimes they're a little cooler. And that corresponds to fluctuations in the density of the early universe as it was growing after the Big Bang and clumping, like mass was clumping together and forming galaxies. Okay? So they thought, maybe this cold spot that we've just found, this could be where another universe has overlapped with ours while ours was inflating during the Big Bang. Hmm. Then in 2013, the cold spot was detected again by the European Space Agency's Planck mission. And then more recently, it was detected yet again by the Very Large Array Radio Telescope. And they found that the cold spot, and get ready for this, it's this giant void that is 1 billion light years across. It is huge. It is largely empty of everything we understand to be in space. There's no galaxies, there's no dark matter as far as they can tell. So maybe this is evidence of a bubble collision, or I guess a bread collision. These universes have come together, and that's the Venn diagram.
Oh man, do you think they could call it the bread zone? That would be
great. Kind of yeah. So okay, here's the Stranger Things like attempt at explaining this. So maybe the Stranger Things universe and the Upside Down, they're part of all of space and time that's around us, right? But they inflated at different rates, and you can either think of them as bubbles or bread, whatever works for you. Subsequently, the Upside Down could have different laws of physics than we do.
However, based on what we see in the show, the laws of physics would have to be fairly aligned with ours.
I mean, not
just because we don't see people defying the laws of physics, but like the universe of the Upside Down is held together
in
the same way as ours is.
We, or Winona Ryder and Hellboy, can only experience the Upside Down
through three
dimensions and then the fourth dimension of time. So maybe what we've seen in this show, the idea of the Upside Down, is actually not another universe, but it's where two universes are overlapping.
Huh. Well, that opens up all sorts of storytelling possibilities for future seasons.
Totally.
If when you're in the Upside Down, you can defy your expectations of physics if you just, you know, believe in yourself.
So yeah. Positive vibes, man.
Hypothetical question. If there could be other universes with different laws of physics than our own, maybe, maybe not. And if we could go to them, that seems very unlikely, but let's just say we did. You went to another universe that had different laws of physics. Would that universe immediately kill you?
Yeah, because if I depend on, and I do depend on the laws of the physics of this universe to hold my body together.
Right.
I mean, how am I going to go into a universe that has maybe a drastically different structure?
Yeah, like say you go to a universe with your body made of atoms and suddenly one of the four fundamental forces, the nuclear force, is weaker. And so the atoms in your body are just not quite as keen to hold together.
Yeah.
That seems like maybe that wouldn't be great.
Yeah, but this is, so again, this points to the idea that they're overlapping. So that you've still got the forces of our universe overlapping with all of their forces. But hey, it's a television show.
That sounds maybe like a mess.
Yeah, it does. Maybe that's another episode though.
Yeah.
All right, guys.
There you have it. We've rolled through some science, a little culture, a little history, some pseudoscience, all of which seems to flow out of Stranger Things. And so then hopefully this helps enrich your appreciation of a show you already dig and maybe prepares you for some of the twists and turns in the upcoming season, which airs at the end of this month.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Y'all been a lot of fun.
And once more, everything on that table has to go, so don't be shy about grabbing some t-shirts and some buttons.
Thanks, everybody.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. We'll be right back.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notified, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.